Hi, Marty Hart Landsberg. Welcome again to KBOO.
Great to be with you, Bill.
Marty Hart Landsberg taught economics, actually political economy. That's the Marxist-informed brand of economics at Lewis and Clark here in Portland. He's written 7 books on globalization. He also blogs. It's titled Reports from the Economic Front. It's mostly on the U.S. economy. It's for popular audiences and has won considerable readership. Over the last few years, Marty branched out into discussing climate change and recently published a profoundly important essay titled World War II Lessons for a Green New Deal. It's in the journal New Politics. We'll be discussing that article today. That article, as well as his other published works, can be found on his blog. So, Marty, tell us why you wrote that article and outline as much as possible its major themes, and then we can pursue some of them in some detail.
Great, Bill. Thanks for that introduction. Well, I think there's a lot for us to learn from a careful study of the World War II transformation experience. Not that we can duplicate it, but I think there are lessons that can help us achieve the kind of system change that we need to save the planet and ourselves. So let me try and give a little sense of why I think that's true. And when I say we here, I'm thinking of most of your KBOO listeners. I think we know that climate change is real and its consequences are deadly. And I also think most of us know that political and business leaders have just refused to make changes in the way our economies run in response to this climate change. So a lot of people have begun organizing to try and force changes in the system. And we can see all sorts of struggles. There are movements to electrify cars and buses. People are working for solar panels, installing wind turbines, recycling, retrofitting houses, changes in agriculture production. There are lots of things going on. But to this point, it seems to me that these efforts are rather separate, and they're focused on their own area of primary concern, and that we've largely failed to kind of join these efforts together in a way that can help us visualize what system change really means, and thus to convince ourselves and others that a better world is achievable. Now, some people have tried to kind of make these ties by saying, well, we're all doing these things under the banner of the Green New Deal. But to this point, the Green New Deal is really a list of desirable changes. There's no sense of a program or a process of change. And I don't think looking to the New Deal, although it's important in many ways, really helps us understand it. But this is where I think the World War II experience is important. The United States was faced with the need to transform its economy in about 3 years to fight and win in World War II. And they did that by a massive transformation in what the economy produced. For example, defense spending went from about 2% of GDP in 1940 to about 33% by 1943. And that year, about 46% of the economy was focused on spending on military and defense. So the federal government was really big. But it wasn't just that they spent a lot of money. It was, in fact, a transformation, because what they did was say there's some industries that are new that we have to build, like synthetic rubber. There are other industries we need to convert them from producing automobiles to producing tanks or engines for planes. We need new locations for new investment. We need to build housing. We need to train workers. We need to also suppress the production of all sorts of goods, like passenger goods, new refrigerators, all sorts of things. We need to figure out how to allocate stuff. In fact, over the period 40 to 44, non-military production actually fell by more than 10%. So what we had wasn't just, oh, let's just spend more money on the military, but let's convert the economy. And when you start to look at that and say, wow, they really did that. They really solved all these problems, not with a production miracle, because the growth of industrial production from 41 to 44 was no different from the growth of industrial production from 21 to 24. Yes, the economy grew, but the massive increase in military was tied to a massive restructuring of the economy, suppression of certain goods, allocating, rationing of other goods. So there's a way in which we can gain confidence that transformations can happen. The other thing that I think we can learn from is that the economy is interrelated. And so when they were planning these things, they had to say, well, what investment do we need in agriculture? What investment do we need in rail? What investment do we need in housing? What do we need for ships, planes? And not everything could be done. How do they all fit together? What things are synergistic? What things are contrary? We have all these groups working on changing different parts of the economy, but they're not really talking to each other. They're not really developing a coherent, shared vision of what a transformation would look like. The third lesson that I think is really important is that all of these changes didn't happen because of private enterprise taking a leadership role or production for profit or market forces. They happened because the government evolved and created all sorts of new planning agencies that could decide how much spending should take place, could decide the location of new firms, could decide how training programs and movement of workers should take place, could decide how to allocate scarce raw materials and components, could decide how to tell which industries to suppress production and which to change the nature of their production. And when you study that, you realize you can't have a major transformation without an intensification of public power. And for us, the question is, well, what are the adequate ways that we would like to see strong government, more strong public redirection of our economy? How did they do it in World War II? How would we want to do it? The last thing that I think is important that an examination of World War II helps to show us is that these transformations are not just simple technical changes where, oh, we spend more money, we figure out how to allocate, we figure out what priorities, you know, where should steel go. Anytime you're transforming an economy, you are potentially shifting class power. And one of the strong things about World War II experience is that the capitalist class was very clear about its interests. In fact, it refused initially to engage in much investment, which is why the government had to take the leadership. And all through the war, it exercised whatever power it could through lots of very interesting mechanisms and ways to ensure that most of the investment would go to a few large companies, that those large companies would control, if not marginalize, small business, that whatever gains unions made would not be sustained after the end of the war, that the reconversion process would benefit them, not anyone else, and that people at the end of the war would say, it was American business that won the war, not the American government, not American workers. And so, in a sense, they were very clear from the very beginning what they wanted to achieve by the end of the war. And if we're really thinking about a Green New Deal, which isn't just try and reduce the use of fossil fuels, but to create a new economy, we have to be thinking now about how to prepare ourselves for the way capital might respond to the kinds of changes that we need to make. So for those four reasons, to conceive of what a transformation looks like, to understand the interconnections of all of our efforts because the economy is interconnected, to challenge us to think about what government planning can look like, should look like, and to prepare ourselves for the kind of class struggles that we can be certain will take place if we're able to make progress, I think there are lots of lessons and experiences that are valuable to us from studying the World War II experience.
Hi, folks. This is Bill Resnick for Cable Radio 90.7 FM Portland talking to Marty Hart Landsberg, an economist. He taught for 37 years at Lewis and Clark College, published 7 books on globalization and economic development in East Asia, I think China, Japan, and South Korea. His blog, titled Reports from the Economic Front, it's mostly on the U.S. economy. It's for popular audiences. It's won a lot of readership. Marty branched out into discussing climate change and recently published a profoundly important essay, World War II Lessons for the Green New Deal, in the journal New Politics, and it can be found on his blog and many other articles on his blog. Marty, I think you distinguished this period from the World War II period. Now we're in a position where the local level has to do a great number of things. In World War II, of course, the local level did maintain morale and superintended the war effort, collected tin cans. I used to, in fact, march into our butcher shop with a whole pail of tin cans that our family used. The local level was deeply involved, but not nearly as much as the local level has to be involved today. And you make that point in your work. Tell us about the local responsibilities.
Well, to start off, of course, the World War II experience cannot be just taken, you know, whole and recreated now. I mean, for one thing, two important things is the war provided a sense of common purpose that took a little bit of time, but after a year or two, by 1941-42, people were fully on board with arming and then, in fact, fighting the war. And the second thing was that because of the Depression and then the New Deal, people were much more favorable to the role of government in carrying out activities and much more suspicious of business. And we have a situation today where, you know, climate deniers may not be in the majority, but people are confused. They know there's climate problems. Business is busily telling us, oh, they can solve all that with technology. Others are saying, oh, there really isn't a climate crisis. And so if we're going to be building commitments to really undertake a full system change, like I think we need to do, which is, again, echoing what you said, that the World War II experience says you can transform an economy. We don't have to do it quite as fast because we're not fighting a war. One of the challenges of the war conversion was that the military itself didn't know what technologies it was going to need. It was evolving as it went along. We have a bit of a clearer sense about what kinds of things we need to do as part of the transformation to transport people, to house people, to grow food, to generate energy. It's not quite as unknown for us. But we face these two problems, that one is people are not necessarily have confidence that there's either a need to or that a transformation can be made, and they don't have confidence in the state. They don't believe that states can really solve problems and direct things well. And of course, their disbelief in the state is because so many people who've been in positions of power have themselves sought to undermine the state and weaken the state. So how do we build up some of this confidence? We need to be thinking about system change, and we need to be integrating that in our work. But the local area is a place where we can experiment. We can do things like the Portland Clean Energy Fund, where we take money and give it to the community to begin to do things, where we can begin to work on our own transportation systems, when we can experiment by building greater solidarity between different groups that are trying to restructure how we live in an urban environment and feed those who live in an urban environment. So I think these are kinds of processes where we can convince people. For example, how is our education working? We know that there are teachers who are pursuing environmental curriculum. It would be wonderful if every neighborhood association met with their teachers and said, yes, teach more about climate change, and we want to talk to you about what you're doing. And every neighborhood group could go to the library and say, showcase environmental books and the nature of the crisis and the possibilities. And so people begin to get invested in this and begin to develop their capacities and their connections. But at some point, we have to recognize that a real transformation is going to require much bigger changes and changes that are connected across the country. And we have to be thinking in those terms and encouraging people to think in those terms that it's possible while we do and engage in local organizing to build up capacities and confidence.
Yeah. Seems to me, Marty, that a growing body of research is demonstrating that the placement of our energy generation should be near the point of use, that is, very near the small cities and the big cities, such that you don't lose energy and transmission and that you don't need a huge, expensive, continent-spanning grid of the kind that the investor-owned utilities are seeking money from the government for. It's a huge boondoggle. And, in fact, it's very unreliable. My line is the big grid is only as reliable as the most vulnerable pylon. Well, they're out of service a lot, and in fact, it's getting worse and worse. Cities can, in fact, build reliable systems, especially when they're confederated over the region. And the research shows that it's the cheapest form of energy. We have all the technologies we need, and we have all the land, the ruined lands we need, the rooftops are a prime source. That has to be done at the local level. Partly identifying where we're going to put generation facilities has to be done at the local level, and it can be done in a radically democratic way. People can be involved in thinking about and making the decisions about the kind of society they want to live in, as to transport, as to food distribution, as to how we manage water resources. Those become important issues even at the local level. I'm sure you agree, but...
Well, I mean, I appreciate your local focus.
You get the last word.
I want to take it back up a second because, you know, you're focusing on energy, yes, and you're focusing on the ways to use, you know, rooftops and things, but we have a housing emergency in the country, and a lot of it has to do with the collapse of the federal housing program. We have a transportation situation where we need, you know, to develop new forms of transportation, including rail. There are a whole lot of issues that all come together to make a different way of living. And I'm not against local activism and local experimentation. But again, if we're really saying that what we're trying to do with a Green New Deal or envision a different world, it's multi-pronged and multi-connected. And a lot of this stuff requires money, and it also requires suppressing existing activities. And if you're going to raise the price of oil, you're going to hurt the airline industry. You're going to hurt the tourism industry as it's currently constructed. How do we move people? How do we decide what those skills should be used for? How do we decide where people should be living and working? How do we decide how to reformat and restructure many of the activities? And if we can't do everything, what goods should be rationed? How do we allocate them? A lot of these things are beyond the ability of local communities and local governments to do. And appropriately, it needs to be part of a broader national plan. And so I'm not saying that the World War II experience can teach us everything, but the question of how you decide, okay, we are going to raise the price of oil really high to move people away from using fossil fuels. We have to be prepared to know. We can't just say, oh, we want a just transition. What does that literally mean? What lessons can we learn from World War II that show how governments can actually engage in planning, how they can successfully say, this is the shutdown. These are the skills you have. These are what we want you to do. In fact, the UAW was saying when the buildup was taking place, auto industry, you can produce for the war effort. And here's our plan. You should unify all the different auto plants and create committees of workers and committees of technicians and committees of managers and use all these plants as one big production process. And we want to be involved in helping to do that. And the auto industry said, no, can't do that, won't do that. The war happened. Finally, the government said, no more cars. And business did all that, just what I'm saying. They shared machine tools, but they didn't allow worker involvement so that the production processes remained top down and workers remained with very little authority. But envisioning how to restructure all of our industries. It's not just about energy. It's not just about housing. It's about the relationship of all these things. And we are so far into this notion of market economy and individuals and separation that we've lost a sense of how do we put this all together? And I'm not saying that the answers are in World War II, but when you study that experience, it helps you begin to very concretely say, ah, here's a problem. How did they do it? How should we do it? How should our vision be different? How might it have to be different? Our aims are different. So it's a matter, to me, of fighting as hard as we can on all the fronts that you're mentioning, but at the same time, trying to come together as a movement that really is committed and understands that without big system change, suppressing the production of certain goods and services that are no longer needed and despoiling the environment and not helpful to us, and get those resources to be doing something else. Those things can't just happen simply and only locally. We have to build up to that process. But if we don't have the process in mind, if we're not challenging ourselves to say, what does a transformation look like? What are the public skills that we need? What are the ways in which capital will always seek to control it and ensure that whatever gains are modest? Those are things that we need to be confronting, and we need historical examples that can help us do that. And the World War II situation is an ideal one for posing those kinds of challenges.
Yeah, Marty, I completely agree. I thought it sort of goes without saying the federal government has to fund it. The federal government has, in fact, a great number of things that must be done, including creating for all localities in this country, creating a set of options for how they can meet the goals. And the set of options wouldn't include nuclear power.
Right.
The set of options would certainly not include contracting out to the investor-owned utilities, the responsibility for building out clean energy, and the federal government would have to have the role of superintending the development of not just the energy system, but the transport system, the agricultural changes towards regenerative agriculture, and which is the only way to sequester carbon, forest health, too. Yes, the federal government has this huge role, but Marty, take a last word, but brief, and we have to sign off. But thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you, Bill. For people who want to get into more of the specifics of how I see the World War II experience and the particular lessons, let me encourage them to read that article that you mentioned, Bill, and to see some of the other things on the blog. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these big questions with you.
The blog is Reports from the Economic Front. Thanks a lot, Marty.
Thanks, Bill.